Hello, hello, hello. We are halfway through Christmas week. Can you believe it? I know lots of people getting off school today, so it's very exciting. Welcome to Kildare Focus. In the next few moments, I will be speaking with Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest and the party spokesperson on housing, Eoin Óibrin, regarding the number of people trapped in direct provision. This is due to rental crisis, which has increased by 60%. Lorraine Rowan, the Chief Executive of Chock Charman, will join me. She's reminding listeners that the services will be in operation over the festive period, and so will a lot of the services, and we will have numbers for those in the next hour for you. So do keep that in mind if anybody is under stress or anxious for any reason due to that. Chock Charman, Women's Aid, Men's Aid, etc. obviously open and their helplines available. John Carmody, the Animal Rights Action Network, of the Animal Rights Action Network, I should say. He's going to discuss animal testing. It has halved in Ireland since the EU directive, but activists do say that the number is still too high. Dr. Conor O'Mahony, he's a Special Rapporteur on Child Protection and he's a Senior Lecturer at the School of Law at UCC, will discuss fostering and within the family how it needs support, resources and regulation. He's written quite an interesting piece. And Gillian Bird is the Head of Education and Media at the DSPCA. Foods not to feed your pets this Christmas. Don't go overboard, I guess. Don't give them the leavings of the turkey, etc. or the fat. It's not good for them. But we'll hear more from Gillian within the next 40 minutes or so. And of course, I want to hear from you this afternoon. Do get in touch. The number to reach me on text and WhatsApp is 0833 97 97 97. That line is in association with Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge. We have the phone line where Dimpna will take your calls. It's 045 901490. And of course, the email studio@kfmradio.com. Now, there's an article in the Irish Times this morning. The number of people trapped in direct provision centres, despite having leave to remain in the country, has increased by almost 60% in a year. That's according to new figures, and the figures were released in a parliamentary question answered by the Minister for Equality, Roderick O'Gorman, to my next guest, Sinn Féin TD, Eoin Óibrin. Good afternoon, Eoin.
Good afternoon, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Listen, It's a very interesting situation. So you have noted that some 1,640 people were in these direct provision centres at the end of November, despite them having been granted leave to remain in the country, meaning they can leave the direct provision system, usually to rented accommodation. So why is it that they couldn't or didn't?
And I've been tracking this issue for quite a number of years. So what happens generally when people are granted asylum or get their leave to remain is they try and get out of direct provision as quickly as possible. Some people would apply for social housing, other people may not be eligible, but either way, their only route out of direct provision once they're legally entitled to do so is into the private rental sector. And of course, as we know, the private rental sector has become a very difficult place to get new accommodation, and particularly new affordable accommodation. Back in 2008 and 2009, there was a little bit of a furore because the then Minister for Justice, who was responsible for direct provision at the time, was threatening to evict the affected families and single people. She was then forced to climb down because, of course, she couldn't evict people into homelessness. So David Staunton, the Fine Gael junior minister, put in place a number of very welcome supports, including ensuring these families had access to what's called a place finder service, run by a number of charities, to try and assist them get access to private rental accommodation. They were also given access to homeless HAP by a variety of local authorities because they were at risk of homelessness and qualified under the terms of that scheme. The problem is, year on year, the number of adults and children who are simply unable to get out of direct provision when they're legally entitled to do so has been growing. So this time last year, it was about 1,000 adults and children. When I first started looking at this back in 2018, it was 600 adults and children. So it's just increased exponentially, and it's just another feature of our housing and homelessness crisis. Because essentially what these families are doing is they are using direct provision as emergency accommodation because they can't get access to adequate private rental in the market.
Now, just to change tack slightly, just ever so slightly, the Housing Minister, who's Dara O'Brien, says the supply of new homes in this country should meet demand sometime around 2024. You're mentioning 2018 there in the terms of the numbers, it was around 600. Dara O'Brien says issues that will likely continue to happen is due to the pent-up demand in the system because of COVID, the pandemic. I think everybody can give some sort of leeway for this pandemic. He said he is considering, though, extending the rent pressure zones to cover the entire country. So currently 24%, so nearly a quarter of the country, is not a rent pressure zone, and the whole of County Kildare is. So If the rent pressure zones were extended to cover the entire country, would that help the situation at all, Owen?
Not at all, because even if the rent pressure zones were extended to the entire state, they don't apply to new properties coming into the market. And they are very, very difficult to police when a property is changing from one tenant to another, because the new tenant doesn't know what the previous rent, or in most cases doesn't know what the previous rent was. I also have to say, for the minister to say that supply will meet demand by 2024, he's clearly living in a different country to the country I'm living at. Almost every independent expert analysis actually says the very opposite. In fact, KPMG recently conducted two very important studies for Dublin City Council and Cork City Council as part of their city development plan reviews. And they factored in all of the information that they've got, including all of the government's targets for public and private sector delivery. And they actually estimate that right out till 2028, demand is going to continue to far outstrip supply, and rents and house prices are going to continue to rise. And while COVID has been a factor in slowing down some supply, it is not the primary reason for the difficulties that we're in. Government investment in affordable housing has been appallingly low, despite the fact that we were promised between 2019 and the end of this year over 6,000 affordable homes to rent or buy. Hardly any have been produced, literally a handful. And the level of investment in social housing is still too low. So, okay, Unfortunately, lack of action by government, a lack of investment by government, has left us in the kind of situation we're in at the minute.
Okay, and obviously you're an opposition, Owen. We know this. You're the Sinn Féin's housing spokesperson. Would say if a general election did take place in 2022 and you end up in the housing minister seat, what are the first steps you'll take? I know you've been asked this question many times before, but I want it to be broken down a little bit to note exactly the first things that you believe should be done.
So the first thing is we have to double direct capital investment in the delivery of social affordable homes, so that we would be looking to produce about 20,000 social affordable rental and affordable purchase homes annually, both by local authorities, approved housing bodies and others. That's absolutely essential. The second thing is we need an immediate ban on rent increases for 3 years. It's an emergency measure, but we have to stop rents rising. And we also have to try and find a way of putting some money back in renters' pockets, and a refundable tax credit worth a month's rent for every renter over 3 years would also be required. And on homelessness, we passed, for example, in the Dáil only 2 weeks ago, during Sinn Féin private members' time, the Simon Communities Homeless Prevention Bill, with initiative of the Simon Communities. The opposition then moved it as legislation, and thankfully government supported it. But we need a much greater focus by government, and if Sinn Féin were in government, we would enact and make that legislation a reality. Much greater focus on stopping the flow of families into homelessness, and when they become homeless, getting them out much more quickly. And again, increasing social housing output would allow us to get families out of emergency accommodation more quickly. And things like the Simon Communities Bill and the Focus Ireland Homeless Prevention Bill, which was tabled previously but opposed by government, would be essential to do that.
Owen, what about those who are lucky enough not to be in the position of being homeless or to that extent that we're speaking about there, or in direct provision, but those that are trying to get on the property ladder and trying to purchase their first homes? Again, in the housing seat 2022, what does Owen O'Brien put in place to make sure that it's more achievable for those first-time buyers?
So first of all, of the 20,000 public homes that we want delivered each year, at least 4,000 of those every year would be genuinely affordable. That would be for people to purchase, and not just first-time buyers, but second-time buyers who are trying to trade down, or folks who lost a family home previously because of the Celtic Tiger crash or relationship breakup. And those are homes that would be for purchase in Dublin at prices below €250,000 and lower again outside. What we would also do is introduce a series of policy measures to try and ensure that where the private sector is delivering private homes on private land, that we're able to moderate the price. Because obviously, I'm looking at house prices both in Dublin and the commuter belt, and we're looking at £350,000-450,000 for standard new homes. So the first is, it is about increasing the direct delivery of affordable purchase homes by government. And second, it's about different kinds of policy instruments to de-risk private sector development, to reduce the cost to purchase a home when it's developed by a private developer on private land.
Okay, well, Owen O'Brien, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest and the party spokesperson on housing, thank you for joining me. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas, Owen. I have seen your tweet a little earlier on today. You have about 15 books there that you're going to get into over Christmas. Have you got any recommendations for us?
You see, I'm a terribly boring person, so I tend to read books around housing policy and climate change and politics. So
yeah, there's no 50 Shades of Grey or Harry Potter in there. I know.
I'm not much of a fiction person, I'm afraid. But no, there's lots of great books out there at the minute. In fact, I was just doing a review for the Irish Times today of Frank MacDonald's most recent book on Dublin. And the past, present and future of the capital city. So I couldn't recommend that highly enough.
Okay.
But lots of other good books out there, including a few I published myself this year.
Oh, okay. You may as well get it in there, Owen. Listen, a very Merry Christmas to you. And
the same to you and your staff and all the listeners.
Teresa has been in touch with us on our text line 0833 97 97 97, and she says, very happy Christmas and a joyful new year, Kira. Brilliant show as always, hun, from Teresa Carey and family in Kilcullen. Thank you so much, Teresa. I hope you have a lovely Christmas, and I hope it's relaxing. I know it's going to be different again this year, but hopefully you have a lovely relaxing one, and thank you for the wishes. Connor Byrne has also been in touch with us this afternoon over in Naas, and of course we hope Connor has an absolutely excellent Christmas. He is one of KFM's biggest fans, and we greatly appreciate it. I'm speaking about the fact that Christmas is going to be different this year. I'm looking on the Irish Times website currently, and there's a story, and the headline is South Africans with Omicron variant 80% less likely to be hospitalised, a study has found. So that's some good news today that we should take, hopefully, and maybe make our day a little easier. Now, obviously, we know Christmas is an incredibly exciting and wonderful time for many, but it's also a really scary time for some people. They can feel very isolated around this time of year. Lorraine Rowan joins me now. She's the chief executive of Chuck Tarman. And just to let our listeners know, Chuck Tarman provides free and confidential support services. That's to women and children in Kildare and West Wicklow who are or have experienced domestic violence and abuse. Good afternoon, Lorraine.
Good afternoon, Kira. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Obviously, the festive period, as I was mentioning, you know, very fun for many, but incredibly scary for others. And you want to let our listeners know that Chuck Tarman's doors are still open and the phones are going to still be answered this Christmas period.
Absolutely. I suppose, as you said, this time of year is wonderfully exciting for many people, but it can also be difficult for others, especially for families who are experiencing domestic violence and abuse. So I was delighted with the opportunity to come on today just to remind your listeners that for anybody who's experiencing difficulties in the relationships, the Chuck Tarman remains open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week throughout Christmas. We do provide refuge, which is emergency accommodation, and that will be fully operational over Christmas as well. So I suppose just for any listeners who maybe need some support, some guidance, some information over the Christmas period, or indeed any time, just to know that our services remain open and that we're on hand to offer support to those who need it.
And Lorraine, sometimes this time of year people do want to donate things. Are Chuck Tarman looking for anything in particular that people can donate, or is that possible at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. People have been so generous on the run up to Christmas, as they always are. And I suppose we've always looked at, for a lot of families that we work with, vouchers are really helpful, because again, it gives families the opportunity to purchase things for Christmas themselves. So it just gives them back, you know, that piece of, not that we're doing everything for them, that they can do it for themselves. So vouchers are always welcome, pajamas, underwear, that type of thing, because again, when we have families, and often when they come to us, they may have, you know, only the clothes on their back. So pajamas, underwear, vouchers are always greatly received. And for anybody who might be interested in donating, we also have a donate button on our website, which is www.chuckturman.ie. And just to say that any donation that's made goes directly towards supporting the women and children who use our services.
And Lorraine, last year obviously was the first Christmas in a pandemic for everybody really on earth. Nobody lived through the 1918, I don't think. But how was it in terms of Chuck Tarman? Did you have a lot of activity that day?
Yeah, we have four self-contained apartments. For those listeners who are familiar with our service, so we accommodate four families at any one time. So last Christmas we were full, and I suppose we have a beautiful refuge. We're very fortunate to have it. So any of the families that stay with us have their own cooking facilities, their own bedroom, bathrooms. So like that, they were able to celebrate Christmas, you know, privately within their own families, which was lovely, because obviously we all know the difficulties that come with COVID and being able to enjoy Christmas and important events. So the families in refuge had a lovely time, thankfully, in the circumstances, obviously, that they were in. And also, I suppose, on the run-up to this Christmas, some of the local schools in Naas were very generous. They were doing collections for us and donations, and the courthouse in Naas as well has made some generous donations towards us, which has gone directly towards ensuring that the children and the families who are staying in refuge have a lovely Christmas. So we're really hopeful that the families who are staying with us will be able to celebrate it, you know, in their own way, obviously, but obviously still to have that privacy and safety and the comfort of knowing that they're in a safe place.
Okay, and to let people know, if they do want to donate, like Lorraine was just mentioning, Chock Charman's website is literally chockcharman.ie, and the number, the helpline for Chock Charman is, and for to help women and children across the whole of County Kildare and West Wicklow, it's 045 527 584. And I just want to give out a couple of other numbers just before Lorraine goes. So on Garda Síochána's number obviously is 112 or 999999. Women's Aid, that number is 1800 341 900. Childline is 1800 666 666. The Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, it's 24-hour national helpline, 1800 77 888. The National Mail Advice Line, 1800 816 588. And Samaritans, that's 116123. So obviously they are still here this Christmas, and that is what the website is called for those who are looking for help across the Christmas period, and especially on Christmas Day, the days before and the days after. It's stillhere.ie for national and local support services available, which Chock Charman is one of. Lorraine Roan, the Chief Executive, thank you so much, and we wish you, of course, a very Merry Christmas and everyone at the organisation.
Thank you, Ciara. Happy Christmas to you and your listeners.
Now, my first guest this afternoon was Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest and the Sinn Féin spokesperson on housing, Ono Brin. And we have a texter here on 0833 97 97 97, and Shay is his name. Hi, Shay. How are you doing? And he says, hi, Ciara. Does Owen and the housing minister not see they're creating the housing crisis? I'm a landlord since 2005 and selling in the new year as my tenant is leaving. All rules now on tenant side and tax to the hilt. Can't wait to get out. He says he wants a rent freeze for 3 years. It says it all. Merry Christmas from Shay. Thank you, Shay, and a very Merry Christmas to you. And it's very interesting seeing people's difference of opinion on this, because it's such a complex issue, obviously. Now, going on to another complex issue, the Animal Rights Action Network spokesperson John Carmody is on the line. He's going to discuss animal testing with us. Good afternoon, John.
Thanks for having me on, Ciarán.
Well, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. Listen, John, animal testing in this country has halved since the EU directive, which obviously is a good thing. But yourself and other activists are saying that the number is still too high.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of your listeners, Ciara, tuned into the show today, just to give them a bit of a background, that new statistics for 2020 came out from the Health Products Regulatory Authority, basically the governmental department that oversees the use of animals and testing in this country. So they obviously release statistics each year, and they have been doing so for quite a while. And going back to 2013, there was some really high figures of all sorts of animals being used. Now, and of course, the 2020 statistics have shown essentially a half of animals used back in 2013 compared to last year, where over 130,000 animals were used. But we still find that this is way too high. There hasn't been a very big debate in this country about the use of animals and testing, and probably most of your listeners may not be aware that dogs are being used yearly in these tests, and other sorts of animals such as horses and guinea pigs, and
animals,
of course,
that we
usual
would have
suspects.
As pets is
exactly,
probably
yeah.
What you're trying to say.
But it's still,
can I just let listeners know, John, that the scientific procedures involving animals can only take place following a detailed submission of the planned studies and subsequent approval by the Health Products Regulatory Authority. That's on the basis of a favourable harm/benefit analysis. So if we take what they're saying there in terms of harm/benefit analysis, what could be possibly put in place in terms of getting these products to humans without having to test on animals, but obviously there'd be no harm brought to humans?
Good question. Well, here's the thing. There's been an obsession for so long, and I'm not a scientist and I'll never claim to be a scientist, but still, someone should be tapping the backs of those who fund these experiments and those who use these animals in experiments. We've been using them for bloody decades, Kira. You know, there's been hundreds of millions of animals using these tests. Everything from mice and rats, monkeys, dogs, pigs, you name it. Now, I'm on about tests all over the world. And yet, here we are today, and we still haven't found the cures for killer diseases such as cancer, Parkinson's disease, stroke, HIV, AIDS, all these killer diseases that, you know, that could in one way or another cross any of our paths at any time. And unfortunately, what really makes me kind of scratch my head about all these tests is that, you know, even for instance, the amount of mice and rats, and they're not a favorite for anyone. Any member of the public wouldn't really have any heart for a mouse or a rat. So it's very hard to get people to try even relate to the suffering of those poor animals. However, but what have they not learned in the tests last year with the use of, for instance, mice and rats that they didn't, that they haven't learned back in 2019 or 2017? You know, there seems to be an obsession with using these animals over and over and over and over and over again. We've been doing it for decades, and yes, we still have no more cures for all these diseases that I've just called out. And not only just that, you're putting these animals, first of all, you're breeding them. There's so many industries that are that profit off the breeding of these animals and that ship them, and the companies that use restraining devices and scalpels and all these other devices that cut into these animals, that pin these animals down. And you're putting the animals into an unnatural environment as well. And then you're obviously artificially inducing these types of diseases in a laboratory setting that is so different from what us humans would normally suffer from, you know?
Now, John, I want to just go through some of the stats here. So in 2020, sure, last year, there were a total of 137,988 uses of animals. That was in procedures for research and testing purposes. It did decrease slightly from the 2019 figure by 1,000. And then if we break down the type of animal species that are used, mice, 113,000 uses. John, just out of interest, when you do look at the ranking of the different types of species and how often they are tested on, why is it that mice are so high? Because the next highest is rats, and that's only at 12,000. So literally 100,000 in the difference there.
That's a good question and it's a good point, but it's very frustrating to hear this, especially when we've been, from animal rights campaigners' perspectives, that we would have seen undercover investigations. We've got people
Do you know, John, why they actually use mice more often? Is there? Do you have any idea for the reason behind that?
They've always been the species of choice because, who knows? But
okay,
when it comes, yeah. But here's the other thing about the use of mice and rats as well. And this comes from a former director of the National Cancer Institute. His name was Richard Klausner. He said we actually cured cancer in mice for decades. We had it done. It was a case closed, as a matter of fact. But it simply doesn't work in humans. And I'm not saying here that there hasn't been anything learned from the use of animals in these experiments. However, there's been such a massive amount of waste. There's huge amounts of grants to be made from the use of these animals and experiments. And I think more than anything else, and I need to be, you know, and I want people to know that I am on the side of medical progress and medical research as well. But I think the question we should be asking, Kira, in this day and age, with such modern alternatives that can, you know, replicate so many diseases, that surely we can do things better.
Okay.
Is where we're coming from on this one, for sure.
Okay. Well, listen, John Carmody, spokesperson for the Animal Rights Action Network, have a lovely Christmas and thank
you
for joining us this afternoon. We greatly appreciate it. And in terms of Christmas, I know many of you may be taking antigen tests, so I just want to go through quickly, basically, when to take them, how to know you're doing them correctly, etc. So they do say antigen tests is a useful tool for anyone who is not presenting any symptoms of COVID-19 and who is feeling well. It helps to detect the virus in asymptomatic people. We've heard about them so much over the past near 2 years now. So in terms of taking the test, you follow the instructions that came with the test you bought, as these may vary from test to test. And there is a video online of Dr. Dearan O'Leary just noting how she does it. So what she says is the most comfortable and accurate way to use a nasal antigen test is to push the swab backwards, not upwards. The nasal cavity goes back, not up. So that is a good, when you think about the, you know, the anatomy and you see the the heads and stuff when you're in school, it does go back, and it does kind of go back and down a bit. So obviously, according to the HSE, the general tips are wash and sanitise your hands, put all the items in the test on a clean surface, open the tube, place it in the holder. Some tubes are pre-filled with the liquid and some you will need to fill with the vial of liquid. Blow your nose before you take an antigen test. Open the swab wrapping. Only touch it at the handle. Insert the swab into your left nostril until you feel resistance. That's usually about 2 to 4 centimetres. So when you think about 2 to 4 centimetres, not that long. Then roll the swab 5 times inside the nostril. Use the same swab, repeat it in your right nostril. Insert the swab into the tube until the soft pad is in the liquid that comes with the test. Stir the swab around for about 1 minute to make sure the liquid has a chance to absorb. Squeeze the tube with both fingers and gently pull the swab out of the tube. Place one of the small plastic nozzle caps provided on top of the tube. Drop 4 drops of the liquid into the testing device and wait for the time that's recommended with your particular test, and the result will appear on the test device. And when you finish, they do say put it in a plastic bag and put it in your bin, get rid of anything potentially that could be there. So a lot of people are saying, you know, oh, I'm meeting people for tomorrow, I'm meeting people in the next few days. And there's a tweet here, it's really interesting. It's a demo of how fast you can turn positive. So this person tested yesterday morning, yesterday lunchtime, yesterday evening, and the next morning. So would say the morning previous, it was negative. The lunchtime previous, negative. The evening previous, it was negative. But the next morning, their antigen test came up as positive. So obviously, it's a handy tool to help us. And we're going to be meeting a lot of loved ones over Christmas. Moving on, I am joined now by Dr. Conor O'Mahony, the Special Rapporteur on Child Protection and Senior Lecturer at the School of Law in UCC. Good afternoon, Conor, excuse me.
Good afternoon.
I don't know who Brian is. Apologies. Conor, the majority of children in this country will be placed in foster care if their parents are unable to care for them, sometimes with a relative. But as you note in your article on the Journal, that ultimately the responsibility will be with that TUSLA. It provides a range of supports to both the children and the foster carers themselves. But obviously, more is needed, especially when it comes to support, resources and regulation, you say. So I guess to begin, just speak about the regulation in terms of the legal system here in this country.
Yes, so as you mentioned there, when children aren't being looked after by their own parents, they enter state care. And typically when they enter state care, TUSLA is the state agency which then has responsibility for those children. And in most instances, they'll be cared for by a foster family. But TUSLA have the obligation to oversee that placement, to assess the child's needs, to review the placement and to provide support for the family, for the child and for the foster carers. So that is the sort of default position. But there are different pathways into that arrangement. It can be by court order, and there's been quite a bit of research done on the court side of this issue. But it can also happen by way of agreement between TUSLA and the parents. And that's the angle that myself and my colleagues, Kenneth Burns and Rebecca Brennan, were looking at in our research, what's called a voluntary care arrangement, where the parents agree with TUSLA that the best thing for children is to enter foster care. But when we began to look at that, we discovered that even that then breaks down into two separate types of arrangements. You have the formal voluntary arrangements where an agreement is signed between TUSLA and the parents, and then TUSLA take on that legal oversight responsibility and provide resources to support the placement. But there's this other category of cases called private family arrangements, where essentially TUSLA leave it to the family to work out an arrangement for themselves. The child goes into the care of, say, a grandmother or an aunt or something like that. And TUSLA essentially then steps away and leaves it to the family to get on with things without that same level of oversight and that same level of resourcing and support that you would receive in the case of a formal placement.
Conor, my first question is in terms of the voluntary care arrangements and fostering. In many of those cases, when you're saying that the parents of the child obviously give permission for their child to be cared from these other people, whether it's a foster care or a relative, are there many cases where the fostering will turn into adoption, or is it very rare in this country for fostering to turn into adoption? Because I've heard many stories that it takes an awful long time. I know people personally that their adoption only fully went through when they were put up for adoption by the time they were 18. That wasn't even through the fostering system.
Yes, I mean, that's a good question. The pathway from fostering to adoption was something which for many years was almost impossible, actually, in Ireland, because of issues relating to the relating law and issues relating to the Constitution. The hurdle that was placed in the way of that process was almost insurmountable, and so in essence very few people managed to clear it. And now following the children referendum back in 2012, when we amended the constitution to make that easier, that then took a while to implement, but there was legislation passed, it was 2017 I think, which has now shortened that period. So where previously it was almost impossible, it now is a more realistic option after a 3-year period, potentially, that a child who's in a long-term foster placement could move towards adoption. But that is a relatively new development, and it's still just bedding in that to create that pathway to greater stability for some children.
Now, you worded the private family arrangement as stepping away, or I guess stepping away. You note the significant disadvantages in your article here. So just highlight some of those to our listeners.
Yes, so if you have a private family arrangement, if we compare that to a formal foster care arrangement, there are a couple of significant differences. So one is with respect to the legal position. The legal position where you have a formal arrangement is that the child is in the care of TUSLA, who then delegates some of those powers to the foster parent. So the foster parent would very much have the legal power to care for the child, and TUSLA ultimately would have the power to make decisions on behalf of the child, be that medical care or travel or so on. In a private family arrangement, you have a relative usually who is looking after a child but who has no legal authority or no legal responsibility to care for that child or to make decisions on behalf of that child. So they couldn't, for example, take them to the doctor and consent to medical treatment. If the parent decided they wanted the child back at any time, they would be fully within their rights to demand the return of that child, notwithstanding the fact that that might not be in the child's best interests. And then the second big issue would be around the TUSLA's role in supporting that placement. So in a formal foster placement, TUSLA would have a responsibility to resource the placement. There would be a foster care payment of over €300 a week per child, which the foster parents would receive to support their work in caring for the child. And there would be regular reviews and inspections. Whereas in a private family arrangement, there's no resourcing, no money or no other supports coming in to support the placement, and no formal mechanism for reviewing the placement either. So that means that it places a significant burden on the relatives who take on that care arrangement. And it also is precarious from the point of view of what happens in the event that things are not going well. TUSLA might not necessarily have the visibility it needs to be able to take further action.
And Conor, just finally, obviously it's very complex and there's a lot more questions and a lot more to explain and to be understood in regards to this topic. But you are noting a certain case study or a certain case in the article, and you talk about how private family arrangements which aren't working well can obviously place children at risk. Now, there's a lack of data available, and you do actually note, which I found very interesting, which is obvious when you think about it, like most things, that these private family arrangements is a solution to the shortage of foster carers in this country, because there's obviously strict criteria and approval that's needed from the guards, etc.
Yes, I mean, part of the reason why TUSLA facilitate these kinds of arrangements, it can sometimes happen that because there are strict requirements around foster carer assessments, around Garda vetting, and particularly in arrangements where perhaps decisions have to be made quite quickly, that sometimes the social workers might not want to wait to go through all those processes if there is, for example, a grandmother available who is the best person to take the child. And it might be, as a short-term solution, it might make sense, but as a longer-term solution, it creates this precarious arrangement that I've already outlined. One of the things we found in our research is that ultimately this is something which there's very little known about it. There is no central TUSLA policy governing this practice. There is no reliable data available. It seems to be something that happens in some areas in the country and not in others. And so really, it's something that we didn't set out to study, but we stumbled upon it in the course of looking at the formal voluntary care arrangements. And our big recommendation coming out of that is really that if this is happening, and it seems that it is, we need to know a lot more about it. And once we have that information, we then need to make some serious decisions about whether this is sustainable on a longer term basis.
It's a very interesting study. It's on thejournal.ie, and as Conor's mentioning, he was working on it with a colleague of his. Conor, just give me the name of your colleague there.
So Dr. Kenneth Burns and Dr. Rebecca Brennan, who are my colleagues.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, no, it's a very interesting study, and we will link it if anybody wants to check it out a bit longer. But listen, Dr. Conor Mahoney, Special Rapporteur on Child Protection and Senior Lecturer at the School of Law at UCC. Merry Christmas, and thank you for all your time you've given KFM over the past 12 months. Take care.
Thank you. Have a Christmas to you too. Bye-bye.
Now, many of you may be out and about getting some last-minute Christmas shopping done, or for some of you, it's just your actual Christmas shopping. You're just last-minute shoppers. I'm looking at Maynooth in particular. The main street is quite congested at the moment. Selbridge is looking okay. Kildare Town, it's also quite congested. Just around the main street, kind of at the square, obviously, near the Market Square itself. Yeah, it's quite busy there and in and around the town. So obviously keep an eye out for that. In terms of Naas, it's very busy at a few points throughout the town. Obviously, South Main Street looks quite busy at the moment. It's actually very bad coming out of the town, South Main Street, and North Main Street also. The Salins Road is quite busy both directions there, and down on the Blessington Road there is quite a few minute delay there, so just keep that in mind. Obviously keep the patience together and try not to lose the head. Christmas is only a couple of days away. Then when it comes to Newbridge, the road entering the town from the Tesco side of or the Kildare Town side of Kildare is quite busy. The Athgarvan Road is quite busy also, the main street too, so keep an eye out for that. And obviously in terms of Christmas, we all want to indulge, but some people let their pets indulge, and they probably shouldn't. Well, they definitely shouldn't. The Head of Education and Media at the Dublin Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals joins me now. It's Gillian Bird. Hi, Gillian.
Hiya, how are you?
Good, thank you very much.
Good, good.
So I was mentioning, obviously, we do all indulge around Christmas, maybe even before and after. But a lot of people feel, oh, you know, I'm you know, taking in a few extra calories, I should throw my dog or cat, etc., the odd something. But probably not the best idea, Gillian. There are some dangerous foods and drinks that definitely we should avoid the dog and cat eating this Christmas.
There are, absolutely. I mean, we all know the famous chocolate one. So chocolate is not good. And especially if you're hanging chocolate decorations on the tree. It's happened to me in the past. The cats love them. And the cats will actually eat through them. And it's not just the chocolate, but also the foil that wraps around these things that can be quite dangerous to them. So you need to be very careful. There's no chocolate stockings under the tree. You know, especially if you're doing something for your pets as well. You shouldn't be putting your pets' treats under the tree. You know, like their stockings you can buy quite easily, because yes, they can eat the food, but sometimes they'll eat the packaging trying to get to the food, so you have to be very, very conscious of that. Our human food, especially at Christmas time, has got lots of salt in it. It's very, very rich. Sometimes it has alcohol in it, because we've made either the Christmas pudding or we've got brandy butter and we've leftovers, and it's really a bad idea to scrape that into the dog's bowl, because it could be a whole combination of raisins, and it could be the alcohol, it could be too much sugar, too fatty. Generally, it's not a good plan to give them the leftovers either.
Now, also Christmas plants, there's some to look out for in terms of your pet.
There is, yeah. Poinsettia, the lovely red leafed plant you get at this time of the year, that can be quite toxic to them, as can lilies, the lovely white lilies. The pollen that's inside them is actually very toxic to cats, and sometimes they can brush against them and it gets on their fur and they lick it off, and it can actually make them quite sick. And obviously things like holly berries, mistletoe berries, things like that, they can all cause stomach issues to pets. So it is really important there again that we keep an eye on those things.
Now, some other things that might be popping out of the gifts that are hazardous to our pets are things like silica gel and the wrapping paper or the decorations themselves.
Absolutely. And the sticky tape, because sometimes if a sticky tape sticks to a cat or a dog's paws, or they get it in their mouth, it can damage their mouths the same way as the same as us if we get sticky tape stuck to our lips when we're wrapping presents. So it can be quite bad.
Does that happen to you, Gillian?
Oh, it's happened to me once. Have you never done that? When you've ripped a bit. Oh, rip a
I'm
bit
a
of sellotape
good rapper.
Off. Oh, you're a good rapper. Oh, a bit of sellotape stick to your lip, pulls off the skin. It's lovely. Absolutely. Tinsel, glitter, any of these sort of things, they're not great for pets. And other things, like I do it myself, you've got to be very careful. For example, if you're putting your Christmas cards, if you have a fish tank at home and you're putting your Christmas cards on top of it, be very careful about things like
never
glitter on your
that.
Christmas cards. Yeah, I hate glitter. Glitter drives me bonkers. But glitter sitting on top of your fish tank or on top of your hamster cage or any of these things, it can fall in and it can cause problems in the future. So you just need to be very, very careful and conscious of those things.
Yeah, yeah. Great. And absolutely, hopefully ourselves and listeners will be more conscious about these things. Just to let people know, Gillian, before you go, there are a couple of things that you can feed your dog or cat, providing they're healthy and not allergic to the following foods. They are safe to give them a tidbit, as people may say. So turkey meat, salmon, lamb, scrambled eggs, green beans, Brussels sprouts, parsnips, carrots, peas, swede, mashed potato, best without the additional butter, because as Julian was pointing
Absolutely.
Out, the fats, etc., we don't want. The new potatoes, the sweet potatoes and yogurts, but check the ingredients and don't feed if xylitol is listed, as this Correct. Is toxic to dogs. And I heard about that when I had my dog Julian, and it was something that you don't know, and xylitol is actually in a lot of things, so keep an eye out for that. It's XYLITOL. Julian Bird, Absolutely. The head of education and media at the DSPCA, Merry Christmas. Thank you for joining us throughout the year, and thank you for that advice.
No problem. Thank you. Have a great Christmas.
Thank you, Gillian. And thank you all for listening this afternoon to Caoimhe Harney, Dimna Murphy and Owen Beattie. Take care, and I will speak with you again in the morning. Ben is up next with K-Drive Go.